Dr. Culler of the veterinary school at UC Davis has developed a new test for the BSE agent in animal feed.
Well, good afternoon. I appreciate the opportunity to come and visit. I'll tell you a little bit about me. I grew up in Kansas, a small farm near a town that had fewer than 200 people in it. Spent some time in the military, came back, ended up in school, College of Agriculture at Kansas State University. Then I came to Davis and got my PhD, and now I'm on the faculty at the UC Davis School of Veterinary Medicine. I manage a teaching and research center in Tulare, California. And a little bit about California. We're the number one agricultural state in the nation. We're the number one dairy state in the nation. And Tulare County, where our teaching and research center is located, is the number one county in dairy production in the nation. If you took Tulare County out of the state of California and let it stand alone by itself, it would be the fifth largest dairy producing entity in America. And in North America, the sixth largest. So I come from an agricultural background. I work in the School of Veterinary Medicine, and my job is to do teaching and research on public service in agriculture. At Tulare, we train from high school through postdocs and PhD in production medicine. And we think of the dairy farm as a food manufacturing facility. Every day it produces raw milk, dairy beef, liquid and solid waste, and we have to manage it on a daily basis for animal health and well-being, public health, environmental health, and still make money. And so one of the issues that we talk about and that we're going to work on and discuss today is to talk about mad cow. Mad cow is one of several different transmissible spongiform encephalopathies. So I'm just going to say mad cow, okay? There are these encephalopathies in ungulates, in cats, in primates, in mink, and in the wild deer and elk. Now, BSC, the causative agent that most of us think it is an abnormally folded protein. It is folded, so it's very tightly bound and is not easily handled by any chemicals or any other kind of processes. This abnormal protein then can get in the nervous tissue, particularly in the brain, and it multiplies itself and becomes a space-occupying lesion. So it was first recognized in 1986 in the United Kingdom. There were about 178,000 cases in cattle between 86 and 2000. And the evidence, when the epidemiologists look at what was going on, they determined that it was being spread in the feed by feeding meat and bone meal. So spreading it in the feed that way. So in 88, the feed ban of ruminant offal or parts of the ruminant as the feed daddy would put in place. In 1997, the U.S. and Canada put a complete ban on these ruminant products being in the feed. So trying to put a major hurdle in the cause of the spread of this disease entity. Now, in the animals, there's no observable signs of inflammatory disease or an immune response. So it's a very small molecular weight protein. It's smaller than a virus. And it's resistant to formalin, disinfectants, ultraviolet radiation, extreme heat with time, and different proteases. Now, just within the last year or so, there are some new enzymes that are being produced that it's being reported they have the ability to at least reduce the infectivity of this protein. And so I think science then is making some progress. To diagnose it, it has to be diagnosed post-mortem. There's no anti-mortem or there's no live animal diagnostic test. So if an animal exhibits clinical signs, then the brain can be taken out. The tissue from this specific area of the brain can be looked at through immunohistochemistry with ELISA or Western blot. So here you can see the white areas. That's the space-occupying lesion caused by the protein. So the brain looks like Swiss cheese, and that's what causes the signs. Here is the immunohistochemistry test that the brain tissue then, this is a definitive diagnostic test. The tissue comes in and lights up with that, with the appropriate controls. Then you have a positive case of mad cow. Now, one of the concerns is that there's a human counterpart to this, that it's called a Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, and there are tissues from these variant form of this disease, and BSC looks very similar in macaques and in mice. So there's some concern that this may be transmissible to humans. The median age is about 29 years of age, with the youngest down to 12. And there is a specific gene part for this. They're homozygous in the methionine codon of the prion protein gene. And so we think, as scientists, that there's a genetic component to this. And there's strong epidemiological evidence to this, in that during the time when the mad cow outbreak was going on in Europe, millions and millions and millions of people ate millions and millions and millions of doses of meat contaminated with this, yet there were a relatively few number of people that actually broke with the disease. And as epidemiologists follow this, the peak has been met, and the number of human cases is on the decline, as well as the animal cases. In the United Kingdom, you can see the peak was around 92, 93, with only a few cases in 01, no cases in 03 or 04 reported yet. So it looks as though that, as far as the animal portion of the disease, that it has really died off and not continued, that the control measures in place are helping out quite a bit. So when you look at this from our perspective, there's a lot of hysteria. A lot of panic occurred. There were the first few cases in Canada a couple of years ago that showed up that created a lot of panic. And it traced back to animals receiving feed before the ban, and it was the right age group, and they traced it back to feed from Europe had been transported into Canada before the ban, fed, they broke with the disease. In December of this year, in Washington State, there was a single case found in the United States. When the tracebacks were done, that animal came from Canada, and she came from an era before the feed ban as well, and that they could trace it back to the feed mills, and so that animal then was traced back not as originating in the United States, but originating in Canada prior to the feed ban. All the animals of that farm were slaughtered and tested. Even the babies were slaughtered and tested, and no other animal became positive, and no other animal related to her was positive for the disease. So we think that the risk approaches zero as long as these bans and these things are put in place. And so one of the things is people say, well, how do you know? How are you going to watch for this? What are you going to do? If you go back and you look at the epidemiology, it's clear that it shows that it's transmitted through the feed in the animals, that feed bans are in place. and that only a small amount of vertical transmission occurs. In other words, from mother to baby in utero, then if we can find the sentinel cases, eliminate them, keep the feed band in place, and then monitor it, we should be okay. And the epidemiology is showing that in Europe right now. Plus, the feed bands that we've had, there have been no cases in the United States as well. The incubation period of this disease is 2 to 8 years, and so the ban in 97 is in place. We're on the outside end of that incubation period for the animals. So if an animal got it, then this incubation period, we're running out the very far end of this incubation period in the animals. And so we think that it's clear that only with a couple of cases showing up in Canada and no cases showing up in the United States, that this ban has been working, and that we're on the outside edge of being in the clear. But this clinical signs are very clear. They're ataxic. They have an abnormal behavior, and you wouldn't miss it. No one in this room would miss that there's something wrong with this animal. Now, when you see that, it could be a common disease like rabies. It could be a mad cow, or it could be lead poisoning, or it could be a listeria, a circling disease, something like that. The point is that clinically, you wouldn't miss this animal if she's showing clinical signs. And you can get her in, do the tests, and find her. Now, with this incubation time being 2 to 8 years, if she's early in the incubation, then yes, no clinical signs. You're not going to find this animal. You're not going to recognize that she has it. That is true. So they changed their temperament. They decreased in their production and weight loss. For instance, on dairies today, most of the dairies have automatic milk readers. The cow's milk production is measured 3 times a day every day. If she drops off in milk production, it's going to show up on the computer right away within a matter of hours, really. And then the herdsman and the people can take a look at this animal, the veterinarian, and see what they can see. But the lesion is primarily in the brainstem, where we showed in that earlier slide. Now, the feed band, what all does it entail? All material from downer cows. It used to be that if a cow came in, she had to be able to walk into the slaughter plant under her own power, but maybe she went down and couldn't get up. The on-site veterinarian would inspect her, and then he either said, yes, she can go in and be slaughtered for further inspection, or no, she has to go into rendering, or she becomes oils and fats and other things. If she's down and the veterinarian determined that she could go ahead and be slaughtered, then he would tag her, and then once slaughtered, then she would undergo another visual inspection to look at the organs and tissues beyond what the normal cow was. Then if found normal, then she could go ahead and enter the food chain. Now, none of those cows can go into the food chain, the human food chain at all. Any cow that's a downer cow at the slaughter plant will not be slaughtered, will not enter the food chain. She may go into the pet food chain, she may go into other animal feeds, or into cosmetics, or other oils, or greases, things like that, but not into the food chain. In addition, material from cattle dead before reaching the slaughter facility, that's not allowed to enter the food chain. In fact, it never was, but they just reiterated. Specified risk materials, we'll go into those in a minute. And then mechanically separated beef. I think most of you have the vision in general that a cow goes in, the carcass is broken down, and there are many people taking the meat off of the bones and making the different cuts and those types of things. Now, more and more and more, it's a mechanically separated meat that has been done. And so it was more efficient, more time efficient, but there was more risk of bone and other brain tissue getting into the system. So now all mechanically separated beef is not allowed into the human food chain. And then carcasses of cattle over 30 months of age cannot undergo this kind of process. So we talk about specified risk materials. The small intestine, the tonsils, regardless of age, cannot go into the food chain. In cattle over 30 months of age, the brain, skull, eyes, and spinal cord cannot go in to the human food chain. So these are the specified risk materials. The feed rule changes then. No mammalian blood or blood products can be fed back to ruminant. Blood is very high protein and is a very low-cost, high-protein nutritional element that had been put back in. So cow blood could be fed back as a protein source to cows. Now that's banned. No ruminant blood can go back to ruminants. So no cow, sheep, or goat blood can be fed back to ruminants. That's banned. No poultry litter can be used for feed to ruminants. And you might go, wait a minute. These banned substances, ruminant cannot be fed to ruminant, but ruminant protein could be fed to swine or to poultry. And so these products would be put in poultry feed in the pan in front of the chickens, and we all know they're not notoriously clean eaters. They scrape stuff off. It would get in the poultry litter, and so it could get there. But the poultry litter could be processed and used as a source of protein and fed back to young livestock. And now that's banned. Again, that's another hurdle, going that extra set of caution to do it. No plate waste can be fed to ruminants. Just like today, not all of us cleaned our plates up, did we? The material left over from our lunch then is to go into a receptacle where it's cooked, and then it can be used as an animal feed or can be used in other byproducts. But now that cannot be used to go back into ruminant feed. And then feed mills must have separate equipment for production lines dedicated to non-ruminant feeds. In other words, if you have a feed mill now and you want to produce feed for cattle, you have to have a separate set of equipment that does only cattle feed versus equipment that can make pet food or poultry or fish food, things like that. They're completely separate in order to avoid some cross-contamination. Now, one of the things that we did, we knew that these bans were going to be in place and that the meat and bone meal was a critical element. So we looked at using new techniques. Actually, we started visiting with our friends in forensic medicine, and we were using PCR, polymerase chain reaction type methodologies, to look for this potential contaminant in feed. And I'm sorry that it doesn't show up all that well here, but if you look at the dime, and about 4 o'clock from that dime, there's a little speck of material. That is the meat and bone meal that then we would mix into that dish of mixed blended feed, use our PCR, and then pull it back out. And we could tell if it's cow, if it's goat, or if it's sheep, pig, or chicken. And so then we could say, aha, this feed's contaminated with a prohibited specified risk material, or DNA, from a cow. And then we could stop it from being fed and stop all the downstream consequences. Right now, this test, we can work in the laboratory, and we can detect 1 pound per ton of feed. So if there is 1 pound of ruminant DNA out of nearly 2,000, we could find that DNA in there and label that material and get it back out. We're actually a little bit below that, but we're continually devising the technique. This is a test that takes about 5 hours from start to finish and has a pretty good reliability to it. And we're negotiating with the government right now to get this validated so it could be used out in the field. The old test to look for this material was looking under a microscope. So you put it under a microscope and you look for bone or hair or something that wasn't there. One person could do 2 tests a day. So you can see that they didn't look at it very often. The next version was an ELISA or an antibody-based test, and that can pick up at best about 1% contamination versus ours, which is 0.05% or below. And so we're using this new generation technique, forensic medicine type approach, in order to give a good quality control measure to this system of animal feed, which is the primary way in which this disease is transmitted. Now let's talk a little bit about 911. We know that it changed our lives, and we know that it triggered a lot of events. And we've heard about suitcase bombs, other devices, all the way from space. I'm going to bring you all the way down to the cow, okay? Agriculture, our food system. We're going to talk about, and you'll hear a lot about agroterrorism if you haven't already. And that is the deliberate introduction of a chemical, a virus, a bacteria, or some agent into the food chain with a specific approach or a specific attempt to either kill a lot of people, kill a lot of animals or crops. They could make people obviously afraid of the food chain. What if I told you today that all of your food that you ate had BSC prion in it? Would you eat here tonight? Of course not. No one would. But it's not the problem. But I'm telling you, that's the approach that might be used to either to make people afraid of the food supply or create a devastating economic impact. And we'll talk about that. And then disrupt international trade. You can see what one case of mad cow in the United States that originated in Canada shut us down from exporting beef all over the world. And it didn't even originate with us. But that's the economic impact that some of these things we talk about, agroterrorism, can do. Obviously, the social economical impact. Let's say that all of the dairy industry in Tulare County was shut down. There would be thousands and thousands of people out of work and then looking for help economically and medically and what to do. Agriculture in the United States, 1 in 8 jobs is directly agriculture, and then the downstream multiplier effect is nearly 40-1. And so disrupting agriculture would have a huge economic impact on the United States and with our trade. The general public really, we think, takes the safety and the wholesomeness of our food supply for granted. Economic terrorism like hoof and mouth or foot and mouth, we'll talk more in depth about that in a minute. But again, direct, indirect, and trade losses come into play. The loss of political support. You can see what's going on now with trade wars, trade agreements, and those types of things between us and New Zealand, Japan, and Europe, all based over one cow. again, public criticism. There's all the way up to you should have known, all the way up to how could you have known, and everything in between. And everybody up and down the streams blamed for not doing more about this, and so on and so forth. Social instability, again, mass panic, major food contamination with human illness. Think about a few years ago in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, when cryptosporidiosis was in the water supply. 400,000 people estimated got sick, 4,000 or so got hospitalized, and 100 or more people died. And immediately, the cryptosporidiosis organism was blamed on dairies. The government officials went back, they looked and looked and looked, never found where the dairies were contaminating the water supply. But what they did find was, several months later, is that out into the lake, several thousand yards, was a discharge of raw sewage coming from a treatment plant, and the cryptosporidiosis came from human waste and not animal waste. But the dairies were economically devastated. The dairy industry was blamed for it. A lot of panic. A lot of things went on about that. Think of what just a couple of letters of anthrax in the mail did to the psyche of our nation and people all over the world. Agroterrorism. There is some historical perspective on this. This was a major, if nuclear weapons and conventional weapons, were categorized, the next was agroterrorism in the Soviet bloc. We know now that many papers have been uncovered, many documents, and we know the list of diseases and organisms that they are producing to the tone of metric tons per year. And over 50,000 people in these documents were identified as working on such projects in agroterrorism, both in the animal world and the plant world. And so where are these people now? We know that in Afghanistan, documents were uncovered that talked about specific bioterrorist interests and agents they had, foot and mouth disease, rinderpest, Newcastle, hog cholera, foul plague, and plant agents like rice blast, maize blast, corn blight, all things to disrupt agriculture, disrupt both the animal and human food chain. The people, again, studies, a lot of people talk about hostile governments, rogue states, economic saboteurs, animal rights activists, ethnic or religious groups. UC Davis has been a specific target of animal rights activists over the years. We've had buildings burnt down, labs broken into, things done. We're constantly hit with attempts at cyber crime. Even in my facility, we get nearly 1,000 attempts a day to break into our databases to do whatever they want to do with them. Global marketing. For instance, in California, the Port of Long Beach has over 1 million inbound containers a year, so the custom officials have to clear one container every 20 seconds, and currently takes 5 inspectors 3 hours to do a thorough inspection of one container. But they have to clear at least one truck every 12 seconds in Detroit, and I just can't imagine we'll ever have enough inspectors to take care of things, and that's just two ports that we talk about. So the ability to introduce things into our country, into our food chain, is real. If you look at a hit list of animal diseases, all of these affect animals, some of them may affect humans. If you look, then FMD, rinderpest, heart water, contagious bovine pleural pneumonia, BSE, swine fever, hog cholera, African swine fever, sheep and goat pox, avian influenza, exotic Newcastle disease. Just talking about the mad cow, about 4 months ago, we called up with a panic that a doctor had diagnosed hand and mouth disease in some students in a daycare center. And the newspaper reporters caught a hold of it, and all of a sudden they were calling us and said, "Where's the foot and mouth farm? We know where these families work. If you don't tell us, we're going to go find the foot and mouth disease that's in the state right now that you're not telling us about." Well, hand and mouth in humans and foot and mouth in cattle are two different diseases. They're not the same. But the newspaper reporters had caught wind of this, and they were all, you know, of course, mothers and parents and grandparents were all concerned. Public officials, the mayor, the daycare center owner, everybody were wanting to really put this blame back on the dairy farm where these children's families worked. And it was completely false and inappropriate conclusion they drew, but nevertheless it can happen. But each one of these diseases are foreign animal diseases that can be introduced into the state. For instance, foot and mouth disease in the state of California, we have 1 week to find it before we lose the entire cattle industry in California. 7 days. That's a function of how fast the disease spread, the transport of our animals that we do, and in 14 days, we'll lose everything west of the Mississippi. West of the Mississippi. So we have to really be on our toes. We'll quickly go through. The dairy business in California is almost $5 billion. Beef, poultry, swine. There are about 1.5 million dairy animals in the United States. The poultry and sheep, you can see that California is a large animal industry. Again, the agents, we'll talk about those in a minute. Foreign animal diseases, a lot of international visitors, increased travel to foreign countries. I think we'll hear more about West Nile virus and about transmission there and visitors. Tremendous increase in international trade with NAFTA and other things. Our borders are being opened up. And exposing us to an increasing challenge. In the United Kingdom, well, that outbreak came along. It was widespread. It's a fast-moving disease. In foot and mouth, the pig is the amplifier. If you have a pig, a cow, and a sheep all in the same stall, you give the pig the FMD on day one. On the morning of day two, he'll be sick with clinical disease. On day three, the cow might show some clinical signs to mild, maybe day four. And day seven, the sheep will have it, but with no clinical signs. So the swine is the amplifier animal. And in Europe, in a lot of these farms, they have the old-style farm. They have chickens, the 10 sows in a chicken coop, a few milk cows, some beef cows, some sheep, all in one place. And the pigs would get it, and they would die, but then the farmer would ship things to market, the sheep, and then the sheep would be spread all out, cows, and that's how it would get away from them, and did. But massive slaughter of animals, and then disposal of the carcasses with burning, not so much burying because of groundwater contamination concerns. So in disaster preparedness, say we had to destroy all 1.5 million dairy cows in the state of California, and this was the mode of doing it. Think of all of the respiratory problems, all the air pollution, all of the chemical and groundwater problems we have to deal with and try to get by. These animals cannot be put in the landfill, in the landfills by law. It may vary a little bit county to county, but in general, they can't just be killed and put into a landfill. They have to be disposed of in such a manner. Again, in the United Kingdom, almost 4 million animals, 9,000 to 80,000 a day, and then an additional 1.8 million just in animal welfare issues. FMD has been around for centuries. It's in a large part of the world, but the green part are the parts that are free, and we're trying to keep it that way because of trade restrictions and considerations. Let's talk about something that's an animal health issue that's not really a human health other than the disposal, the economic chaos that it could create, and I mean chaos. But let's talk about a real threat to humans. And this is one near and dear and close to us. Again, this is a typical dairy farm in California, averages about 1,500 animals, milking three times a day with about 25 to 30 employees. And that's our customer. If we can't produce a safe, wholesome glass of milk, then the dairy industry loses their job. When we look at potential threat agents, we look at toxins. Clostridium botulinum A is probably the most toxic for humans. And then there's ricin and saxitoxin, diphtheria, all the way down to anthrax spores, and they're kind of listed in order of toxicity. So botulinum A is at the top of the list. We talk about LD50. That's a dose that, 5 LD50s, you get 100% death loss. When we look at botulinum toxin, there are seven different ones, A through G. A, B, E, and F are the most common toxins in man. C is the most common toxin in animals. But each toxin is antigenically distinct, so there's not one vaccine will protect against all. You've got these seven main types, and then you have almost 80 subtypes, and they're all immunologically distinctive. You have to have a different vaccine for everyone if you're going to try that method. But again, clinical signs in 18 to 36 hours. It could be acute paralysis and death all the way to a gradual paralysis, respiratory paralysis, over time. So it could be a chronic. Pasteurization has essentially no effect on the toxin. So there aren't any terrorists in here, are there? Okay. What we're talking about is an intentional introduction of this toxin into the milk supply. On the farm or in the processing plant, it'll get right through the process virtually undetected and into the food supply right away in a matter of hours, literally. Again, ricin is another type. We won't go through that. We'll focus on BA. There's no validated test for milk. Again, there are different types. These things are easily produced, easily put in. And again, when you talk to the Department of Homeland Security on the human side, their priority is anthrax, 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 because of the letters and the other things. And it truly is something to be worried about, because the respiratory form of that disease could virtually paralyze all of the emergency rooms and the hospitals in the country in a matter of a few days. This is another organism, another thing that could do the same thing, but yet it's just now getting the attention of Homeland Security and of regulatory officials. So the vulnerability, our food supply, our animals are highly vulnerable to these things. They're available around the world. We know from documents that before the sale, the ban was put in place, that some states that we think would not be friendly to us have purchased these organisms, have purchased the media, and have the means to make a lot of these things. What we're working on in the state of California, the previous governor recognized that California was vulnerable. He asked the Secretary of Agriculture and the head of Office of Emergency Services to work together and put in place an emergency response plan and it's called For the Introduction of Foreign Animal Disease. And those exercises have been in place now for a couple of years, and everything from local law enforcement to the National Guard is in place. In fact, exercises have been used where a sample that was designated as suspicious of having BSE, a local Air Force F-16, took that sample, transported it across the nation so that it could be tested in a matter of hours to see whether or not. That's the level of response that our state has in place to look at introduction of foreign animal diseases. We teach these things in class. We talk about these diseases, recognizing them, what you can do about them, the structure, the infrastructure. Who do you call? If you think you got it, who do you call? Not Ghostbusters, you know. But the infrastructure is in place and being tested on a regular basis here in California. But money talks. I've been going to China a lot the last 3 years to work with their dairy industry there. And of course, one of the things they want to do is make vaccines. I've talked to the Ministry of Agriculture in Beijing, China, and they tell me that over 80 facilities are in place, ready to go, that are GLP, state-of-the-art vaccine factories that have nothing to make. And I've been in about 20 of them, and it's true. So, money talks. Things could be produced. In many cases, they're not technically savvy enough to know what they would be producing. I could give them a vial and say, hey, you know, I'm Dr. So-and-so from University of this and that, and we want to make this vaccine for swine. Here's how you do it. Grow it up and just be real careful because it might make you sick. And give them the money and they'd make it. Not only there, but a lot of places outside the Western world can do this. And so we've really got to take advantage of our ability to meet with people and train. Private sector needs to be more aware of the vulnerability of our food supply. Again, people take it for granted that it's okay. Government shortfalls. These are really new challenges. It's all been, so far, just kind of food safety. But we're talking food security. Very different. Intentional introduction, an intentional criminal act. Now, we've had some of those on a small scale. Somebody pouring penicillin into the milk bulk tank. We have a screening system in place. Every truckload of milk is tested for antibiotics before it's unloaded. So we can catch that and dump it before it even enters the food chain. So we've had those kind of criminal acts, and adulterating the food supply is a felony offense right now. So the people who did that then are prosecuted under criminal law. But there is no way to routinely screen for things like botulism or anthrax. And so the government has to rethink how to redirect resources, how do we get these diagnostic tests up and running and get them in place, and how do we create that infrastructure to do it. And it's a big challenge to do that. And still, just look at what happened with the borders being cut off with the mad cow thing. How much did your gallon of milk go up? Went from $1.70 to $5 a gallon. And that's because we couldn't trade and get the replacement animals to keep the numbers up to do. So our numbers shrank, and so the availability of milk shrank, so on and so forth. And that's one cow. What if it had been 1,000? And so that's what we're talking about, is the private sector just doesn't understand the vulnerability that we have. again, FMD and those types of things we talked about, sooner or later infrastructure does matter. We'll see how long that one lasts. But we do have an action plan in the state of California, and other states are working on them or have them in place as well. Again, our strategic plan in California is between the Food and Ag and Office of Emergency Service. The introduction of foot and mouth into the state is equivalent now to an earthquake, a wildfire, a plague, anything like that. Now agriculture is in that arena. We can't lock down all the agriculture. As you go home today, if you drive or you fly, take a look and see how would you protect every field, every pen full of animals that you saw. How would you do it? How would you pay for it? And what cost would that be to our food chain? How would that be reflected at the grocery store? And it would be, you can see what one cow did to the milk price in the United States. Again, communication and trust and adequate animal health infrastructure is needed. I wanted to leave a little time for some questions. Again, we're located in Tulare. It's between Fresno and Bakersfield. We're part of the University of California. You're welcome to come and visit us and visit our website and look and see at the things we do. We have everything from molecular epidemiology to training workers in Spanish and Portuguese on such matters as we talked about today. So you're certainly welcome to come visit us anytime and chat with me or anyone at the facility in our research program. Questions?
Bioterrorism is one of the things rumored to be the favorite method of terrorists in the near future. If a private physician or emergency room physician were to see a couple of patients with a strange paralysis, what would you expect them to look for, and who should they contact?
In this case, around the country, there are different tabletop scenarios and training going on for anthrax and botulism and some of these diseases. And we hope that each hospital and each county agency have their first responders. In this case, if they saw these few cases, they report it to the local public health, and then it would go upstream to the state and federal public health right away, and then increase diagnostics, those types of things. Is the system perfect? The answer is no. We've got to get geared up and make people understand that this is serious.
Well, let's say this happened on a weekend when the agencies were not acting. What would you do?
Well, in this case, we have to wait and see how things work out. In my case, the perfect world, that wouldn't be. The agencies would be available 24 hours a day. In the instance of foreign animal disease, like foot and mouth or mad cow, our system is on station 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, even in the holidays. But on the public health side, that's not the case yet. And we just have to get people up and going, and I hope that's one of the reasons why I'm here, that as a group, we can work on that.
If there were a real suspicion then of potential thousands of persons being affected, but individual physicians saying just a couple of them, there's no means of spreading the word rapidly by calling the National Institutes of Health or calling you and Davis, or is there any other...
In this case, the scenario would be go to the county public health, and then the county public health would report it to the state, and then the state would disseminate information in that manner and bring in the federales.
Too late.
Sure, I agree that it may be too late in some cases, but in case of the food chain, we have a pretty quick recall system in place, but we also have a very rapid distribution system. And so, like I said, we had 7 days to find FMD before we lose the whole state, animal agriculture. So we have to be rapid response, quick turnaround, but we need to get the entire medical community geared up that way. Yes, sir?
I'm a physician. I've always felt that the first thing you want to stop a disease, you want to find out a cousin. Now, I don't understand veterinary things. There was a company in the Middle West that sold its cattle regularly to Japan. And in Japan, they test every cow for mad cow disease. So they wanted to, of course, the Japanese said, we won't take your food unless you check every carcass you send to us for mad cow disease. So they wanted to do it. And the U.S. Agriculture Department said, you can't do that. Oh, you can't do that. And they said, we're going to pay for it. Cows are going out of the country. Why wouldn't they let them do it? I mean, there's that feeling that some of us have that maybe they're covering up something. Is that possible? Or is this simply bureaucratic inertia?
I think that the response is truly based on science. Because we all should know that no test is perfect. No test is 100% accurate. We have variability in the assay itself, in its quality control and production. We have variability in the operators of the test. And so it's been shown that even in human hospitals, you go in and get this blood panel of 25 or 30 things. They take your blood, they run it in, it comes back. There's a 25% chance that one or more of those parameters are wrong, even in that system. Now, let's take an agricultural person who has this test. What happens if their lab finds a positive?
They would check it again.
They would check it again. And then what would happen if the local newspaper got it and then the rest of the world found out, what would happen?
In other words, you really don't want to find out whether the cows have the disease or not?
No, I want to find out in a controlled situation, people who have experience in testing. This person does not. And the people they hired did not have any experience in running a lab.
But then couldn't they send it on to have it checked again in a more reliable lab?
It's better if it goes directly to the reliable lab in this place.
Well, this company just sent it to the reliable lab. They put this company out of business because the Japanese wouldn't take their food.
Well, the company made, in my opinion, also made a mistake. They could have also said, wait a minute, we will take our animals, we will harvest them, we will send you the tissues, Japan, you test it, and then if it's okay, then you'll release the carcasses. What's wrong with doing that?
Nothing, except I think the Japanese said that they wanted them tested before they were sent over.
Well, you see, then they're not being reasonable either. That's not an unreasonable request.
The company goes out of business because the agricultural department obviously is afraid to have this test used widely.
They're not out of business. They're still functioning.
Thank you.
About 10 years ago, it wasn't a matter of terrorism, but there was hysteria about bovine somatotropin. What's the current status on the use, the perception, and any consequences on BST?
The use of BST has no consequences on BSE, or mad cow. So if you use somatotropin, there's no direct relation to mad cow. The use of BST is widely used around the world with specific markets saying, you know, we will not take animals treated with this compound. You may or may not know that every mammal has a BST or a somatotropin hormone in their milk. Humans do, dogs do, cats do, cows do, pigs, sheep, all mammals have that. This synthetic somatotropin that is produced is only two amino acids different than the natural compound. And so it was used to give become more efficient. So on the same amount of feed, you got 8 to 12% more milk. So it was a cost efficiency measure in order to help keep the price of food down. And so it's still used. There are markets who say they don't want to use it. There are organic milks who say, no somatotropin in our milk. Well, it's wrong. It's there naturally anyway. there's no synthetic somatotropin, and that's true because they don't allow it being used. So I hope that's kind of answered your questions a little bit.
Okay, a day ago I heard a news release that there was a new Menkau case disease found in the United States. I haven't heard anything since. In effect, they wouldn't release the location because they said it's being shipped for additional testing to confirm if that's the case. Do you have any information?
We monitor the U.S. DA and the FDA on a daily basis, and they haven't had any kind of news releases that I'm aware of in that case. I think there was a case, a potential case of FMD reported. They looked at it, and it turned out to be vesicular stomatitis, which is a similar-looking disease, but a very different disease. And I'm hoping that's what we're talking about. Instead of mad cow, it was FMD. But I'll check the website again this afternoon. You can go get on and look at the daily reports on the FDA website. Yes, sir?
You said that you could make botulism very easily yes. in the bathtub. I didn't do the calculation in my head because I couldn't. How much mass or volume of the powder that you get would be required in milk to contaminate one truck of milk such that everybody who drank it would die?
Well, if you put 1 gram in, you could have about 5 LD50s per 100 milliliters of milk. So in 6,000 gallons, 1 gram could give you 5 LD50s per 100 mLs. So we could calculate how many doses that is. That's about an 8-ounce glass.
So it sounds like it would be very easy to carry a suitcase of that material across the Mexican border and somehow get it into milk and we'd have a problem.
Yes. I hope you're not a terrorist. All right, thank you.